This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
I'd like to start by acknowledging that today we are gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. I'd also like to introduce myself a little bit further. I have a company called Bridge 8, which is a foresight and science communications consultancy. So the sort of work that we do is using futures to understand the way that the world could be and using science to understand the way that the world works. And so I'm particularly excited to introduce you to Laura Brooks today, because when I first met Laura a week ago when we were planning this session, and I said to her, you know, what is your motivation for what you do and why you do it? I really got this feeling that what pushes Laura is understanding the way the world works. So taking those fundamental ideas and knowledge of the world we live in and the world around us, transferring those to real-world scenarios and seeing the direct applications of that to design things in a better way and to make the world work in a better way. So I'm really excited to be able to introduce Laura to you today. So a little bit more about Laura. Laura is a lecturer in the School of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Adelaide. She has a Bachelor of Engineering with Honours and PhD from the University of Adelaide. She was awarded the prestigious Fulbright Scholarship to research underwater sound transmission at Scripps Institution of Oceanography in California, and she has completed a postdoctoral appointment at Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. Her research has included underwater acoustics, microseisms and flow-induced noise. And in order to design for reduced noise emissions, her current interests include acoustic signal processing techniques and fundamental understanding of the noise-producing mechanisms of flow over bodies like aircraft, wind turbines and submarines. So I'd now like you to welcome Laura to explain what that's all about and give you an insight into her work and her study. Thank you.
Thank you for your kind introduction, Kristen. Okay, I think Kristen's actually been through my journey from where I started as an undergraduate student at the university to where I am now as a lecturer. I've been fortunate to be involved in research in quite a few different areas in the short period for which I have been a researcher. Today I'm just going to talk about two of those areas, ocean acoustics, which is what my PhD focused on, and aeroacoustics, which is what I'm working on now. Just due to time limitations, we'll skip over the seismics, but that was cool fun as well. Okay, some of you here probably know a lot about acoustics, some not so much. Acoustics is quite simply the study of sound. And when we think of sound transmission through a fluid, so through something like the air or through water, it is simply a fluctuation about the ambient pressure. So at the moment we're standing here, we're surrounded by air pressure, which is about 101 kilopascals. As I speak to you, the pressure goes up and down ever so very slightly about that value. Now, sound travels as a longitudinal wave. That's this picture down here. And what that's showing is that we get particles which will compress and then expand as a sound wave transmits through it. However, when we think about sound, we often picture it as a sine wave, so that thing that we've drawn at the top there. What we have is our ambient pressure, which is the dashed dot line around the middle, and then we have the sound will increase above that and then decrease below it. The sound has an associated amplitude, which is simply the peak, peak value, and the amplitude is simply how loud is the sound. It also has something called wavelength, and wavelength is the distance, between two points of the same phase. For simplicity, we can think of that as the distance between two compressions, or the distance between two expansions. Something else that I'll introduce at the moment is frequency, because I'll be talking about that a little bit throughout today's session. Frequency, you can think of like pitch. So if you think of musical instruments, you think of a piccolo. That has a very high pitch or very high frequency. If you think of a double bass, that is a very low pitch or a low frequency. Frequency is simply defined as the speed of sound divided by the wavelength. So the speed of sound in air, for example, is about 340 metres per second. But it's not constant. It depends on things such as temperature and other values as well. In the ocean, it's a lot faster. But that's what sound is. And, you know, it is really a simple thing. It's just a wave. But it's a lot more complex when you try to apply it to a real world environment to see what's happening. So first of all, we're going to talk about ocean acoustics, which is sound propagation through the ocean. Now, why is this important to us? If you go swimming and you duck in under the water, you can't really hear much. However, there's actually a lot of noise in the ocean. There's noise created by shipping, noise created by waves and wind events, noise created by animals. You get little snapping shrimp on the bottom of the deep ocean floor. You get whales and other ocean mammals communicating via sound. And it is very loud there. It doesn't couple well into the human ear, so we can't really hear it, but I won't go into those details. Why do we care about the transmission of sound in the ocean? Now, if we think about how we communicate up here in the air, if I want to talk to you where you are now, okay, I'm using a microphone, but I could just talk and you would listen to the sound waves directly from how I'm speaking. However, if you were standing on the other side of a football field and I tried to talk to you without a microphone, it would be very hard to hear me. Sound cannot travel very far through air before the amplitude becomes too small to hear. If we want to communicate long distances, we use, I guess, waves from the electromagnetic spectrum. So we can use light waves, or more often we'll use, I guess, radio frequencies. We can use those to transmit stuff wherever we want. In the ocean, it's the opposite. Again, if you go swimming and you dive down a few metres, you find that it gets dark very quickly. Light doesn't travel very far through the water before it becomes too small a signal to be able to be useful for anything. Similarly with other electromagnetic waves. We can't use radio waves to communicate. So instead we use sound waves, because sound waves in the water are kind of like the opposite to up here on Earth. Sound can travel really, really large distances and still be loud enough to be useful. So it's efficient sound transmission for large distances. We also are lucky in that sound does travel at about 1,500 metres per second in water, so about five times faster than on air, so we can communicate a bit more quickly over distances. And we already know that marine mammals have, discovered this fact and been able to evolve and adapt themselves to use sound for this very purposes of communication. However, if we want to communicate or use sound in water for other purposes, such as, sonar and things like that, we need to have a very good understanding of how the ocean environment is actually affecting the sound. Because we can turn on a source somewhere and we can go somewhere else in the water and receive that source, but if we don't know anything about the environment in between, the information we're going to get will be very confusing. So there's lots of things that influence, how sound transmits through water, so we're going to have a little bit of a look at how the environment can do that today. First of all, we'll talk about something called the sound speed profile. The sound speed in air on Earth doesn't change very much, changes a little bit with temperature, but it's approximately constant. However, sound speed is actually a function of temperature, salinity and depth, or temperature, salinity and pressure. Pressure and depth are related in the ocean. And it actually increases with all three of those. So if we consider a deep ocean, we consider up near the top of the ocean, we have water which is being heated by the sun. So the temperature of that water is a lot warmer. Hence, we actually have an increased sound speed near the surface of the ocean. As we start to go down a little bit, we'll find that our temperature will drop off very quickly. That's what we call our main thermocline, thermo being for temperature. As we go down deeper still, our temperature does no longer change very much. However, we're getting deeper, so the water pressure increases, and thus the sound speed increases again. So we can actually end up with very complex sound speed profiles in our water column. And this is only one example of many different profiles that we can have. Okay, so we can see we have a varying sound speed profile. But what does this mean? Why does this matter for acoustic communication? I guess if we look at something that we can actually visualise, and that's light passing through a prism, A lot of you, I guess, would have done physics in high school or have gone along to science events where you've seen white light pass through a prism. And you probably remember from that that you're able to extract all of the different colours in a rainbow on the other side. What's actually happening is that the speed of light is different in the air than it does in the prism, is in the prism. And as the light moves from the air into the prism, it's actually being bent or refracted a certain amount. And the amount that it's bent depends upon the frequency of the light, or as we think about it, the colour. Colour is simply a different frequency for a different colour. And as it comes out the other side, it's being bent some more, and again, we can still see the colours are separated. Sound is very similar. If you pass sound through different areas with different sound speeds, you will bend it, and you will bend it different amounts depending upon the frequency. So, okay, we can understand the sound speed profile is going to affect our sound propagation. Another thing which affects it is the sea surface and the seafloor, because if we think of sound in the ocean and we send out a signal, not always, but often, particularly in shallow water, it'll interact with the seafloor on the way to wherever we're trying to receive the signal. And depending upon, I guess, what the seafloor is constructed of, it's going to interact in a different way, and thus the signal that we receive will be different. So if we send out one signal here and receive it here, and we've bounced a path along the seafloor, then the sound that we receive depends upon what the sediment, the seafloor, is made out of. Is it sand? Is it silt? Is it mud? How deep are those layers? Are there multi-layers? Is there anything else on the seafloor of interest that we want to see? So we can appreciate, I guess, that there's a lot of different ways in which sound can transmit through the ocean. In the shallow water, we could have almost a constant speed profile, or we can have on the right there a profile where our sound is refracted slightly downwards, and it interacts a lot with the sea surface and the seafloor. So for shallow water propagation, the seafloor is a very important entity. We need to be able to relate the parameters of the seafloor to the sound and how it affects the sound. In deep water, we don't always interact with the seafloor and the sea surface. Because we have the varying sound speed, in the ocean sound will be, I guess, bent towards locations of lower sound velocity. So if we have a source at the location of our lower sound velocity and a shallow source angle, we can actually find that the acoustic signal will travel in an acoustic channel through our ocean without interacting with the sea surface and the seafloor. And the good thing about that is we don't then have to account well for the seafloor, and we can transmit really, really long distances with a really high signal. Now, for me, I'm interested in all of this, but I guess the things I've mainly been looking at have been shallow water sound, and I've been looking at, well, what do we need to know about the environment in order to understand how it's affecting the sound and the signals are going to receive. So what do we need to know about the sound speed profile? What do we need to know about the sea surface and the sea floor? And we can think from, I guess, a perspective that if we want to communicate in the ocean, or if we want to have improved sonar performance, the better the model that we have of our ocean environment, the better that we can do that. So I won't go into too much detail about, I guess, the details of what we've done in that area, because, I mean, it really does fall in that main scope of what we're trying to do and why. But I will just briefly, I guess, give you a bit of a taste of what we physically did. So back in 2006, in August, September, we went up to Massachusetts and went out on our research vessel NOR, which is this fellow on the left here. That's the day before we went out. It was being loaded up. And we went out for 2.5 weeks to do some acoustics experiments. This is where we were. So we're off the east coast of the US, on the New Jersey shelf, just on the edge of that. And what we do when we want to do these experiments is we have to have ways, I guess, of receiving signals in the ocean so that we can measure the sound. And we basically drop into the ocean acoustic arrays. So these are arrays, meaning that we have lots of single recording elements, and each of those recording elements is called a hydrophone. So it works basically the same as a microphone, but hydro, meaning that it works underwater. And we can record signals on all of those simultaneously, and then we go to a computer and use lots and lots of complex mathematics and signal processing to be able to relate what we've received to, I guess, the acoustic sounds that we're actually trying to listen to, and again relate that to the sound speed profile, the ocean floor, and things like that. This little figure up on the right there is just a little aside. This array that we have there actually recorded probably about 90% of the data that I used in my PhD, and when our dedicated group went to pick it back up off the seafloor, they actually snapped a line attached to it, and it was lying on the seafloor, and they weren't sure if they were ever going to get it back again. They sent down a claw and thankfully got it first go, but they had to manually haul it up quite a bit before they could put it back on a winch. And this is them at 2 or 3 in the morning working hard to make sure that we got our data back. But they did an excellent job, and thanks to that, we were able to do really well. Now this here, I'm not going to go into too much detail of the figures, but the idea is that on this particular array of hydrophones, I was looking at sound from sources that we were towing, sources that we were lowering, and also just ambient noise. So when we had our sources turned off, there was noise from other shipping and ocean waves and things like that. And from those, I was trying to determine acoustic propagation paths between all the different hydrophones and relate that to the ocean environment. And from these three figures here, you can kind of see that there's some, I guess, some characteristics which are similar in all three. So I was able to use different kind of sources and account for the type of source I was using to pull out the same information. I would like to go into more detail on the ocean acoustics, but there might be some of you that are here to listen to the aeroacoustics, so I'll move on to that area. And we can, if you've got any questions about the ocean acoustics, we can have a chat about that afterwards. Okay, so in ocean acoustics, we're interested in using sound for communication, sonar, things like that. Now I'm looking at aeroacoustics, which is, encompasses noise generated by the flow of fluids over bodies. So, for example, when you have an aeroplane flying through the air, you can have noise generated by the flow of the air over the wings. If you have a wind turbine, like we have on the right-hand side up here, you'll have noise generated as the turbine blades rotate through the air. Similarly, for submarines, they have protrusions, control surfaces, etc. There will be noise produced from that. For varying reasons, we would like to reduce this noise, whether it be to, just to reduce annoyance, because these might not be very nice if you live near an airport. Potentially for health, if you are very close to something which is producing a lot of noise, that can have a lot of negative effects on you. And also, I guess, for defence reasons. Defence obviously would like to be able to have things that you can't hear so that they can undertake covert operations. Now, in order to be able to design these things to produce very little noise, first of all, we need to understand exactly how is this entity creating noise in these conditions. And only when we understand exactly how it's creating noise can we redesign it to create less noise. So I won't go into too much detail on this slide here, but what we have here is a cartoon of a wind turbine, the end of a wind turbine blade, and I'll just very quickly walk you through some noise sources that we can get from this scenario. So we have air hitting what we call the leading edge, so the front of the wind turbine blade, and now that air has some turbulence associated with it. So what that means is that it fluctuates about a bit in a random fashion. And that turbulence is an excellent generator of sound. As that turbulence interacts with the leading edge, we can get sound produced. The air will then also flow over the blade itself, and as the turbulent part of the air in the boundary layer, which is the layer right on top of the blade, interacts with the trailing edge, we can actually get very high sound produced from that. We get a diffraction mechanism that means that trailing edge noise can be one of the most dominant sources of noise production from aeroacoustic applications. Also, we can get vortices produced. For example, on the edge of the turbine blade here, we can actually get little vortices, which are like swirling motion, kind of like what you get if you take the plug out of your bathtub and you see the water swirl down. And these vortices themselves will generate a lot of noise at certain frequencies. So there's a big, I guess, myriad of noise-producing sources on a turbine. The motor itself can also produce noise, but that's not something that I've personally looked at, and it's also something that they've other people have been able to deal with in the past, and already wind turbines that are produced today have a lot less noise from that area. So in order to be able to understand where this noise is coming from and how it's being generated, rather than just simply going out and measuring noise from a wind turbine or an aeroplane, we often have to take a few steps back and we have to look at something very fundamental under controlled laboratory conditions so that we can really tap into one mechanism at a time. So something that we've been looking at is just the trailing edge noise mechanism that I've been talking about. And what we do is we do most of our work in a big box, which is this thing here. And this box is what's effectively an anechoic chamber. You can see it has lots of foam wedges on its roof and walls and even on its floor. And what these do is absorb sound so that you've basically got an echo-free environment. So you've really only got a direct acoustic path between two points. You don't have bounces off the wall or anything like that. Then what we do is we put a wind tunnel through this box. So we have a fan and we blow air out here. And then what we can do is we can put whatever piece we're looking at in front of that air. So up on the top right-hand side, we've got a simple flat plate that we've put in there. Now, the idea is that, OK, in real life, with your aeroplane, for example, your aeroplane moves and your air is approximately stationary. Not really, but approximately. Whilst in here, the plate is stationary and the air moves. It's the opposite effect, but exactly the same thing is happening and noise will be generated in exactly the same way. Now, to give you a bit of an idea of what, I guess, aeroacoustic or aerodynamically generated noise sounds like, what we've got here are two signals for this particular case. The first signal, which is green on the bottom there, is what we have when we don't have anything in there. We just have our air turned on, but we don't have our body. So if we can have that played, thank you. Okay, you can hear very, very slightly that there is some noise happening. And there is already aerodynamic noise being generated. But as soon as we put the plate in, we get the other noise. You can hear we've got a lot more noise. And so, yes, the air is reacting with the plate and creating a lot of noise. Okay, so we've done some work looking at how, I guess, the trailing edge has been creating the noise and under different conditions have been able to pinpoint a few different mechanisms. And then we've gone away and we're now looking at, well, we think we have a good understanding of how this noise is being produced. What can we do to reduce it? And something that people have been looking at a few different places around the world is looking at changing, I guess, the shape of the trailing edge, because you can imagine if you change the shape of something, it's probably going to influence how the air interacts with it and thus influence the sound you produce. So what we've got here is, again, we've got our plate in our wind tunnel, in our anechoic chamber, and we've got three different trailing edge configurations. So the top one is just a flat trailing edge, and the bottom two are what we call serrated trailing edges. And so they're just zigzagged, and they're different sizes. And what we've got on the right-hand side here, I guess, is one set of results for one flow speed, showing what can happen when we put these in there. So if we can have the top one played, thanks. That's what we hear just from the standard trailing edge. And if we can get the second one played, we can hear that the noise level has actually reduced a bit. We've by changing the trailing edge configuration, we've been able to produce it. Now, this is all still a little bit ad hoc. We know kind of how the noise is being produced. We know kind of what we can do to reduce it. But until we actually then go and take our redesigned configuration and put it in our test conditions, we can't tell you exactly how much it's going to reduce it and exactly at what frequencies. There's theories out there that say what's going to happen, and there's experimental evidence out there, But there's still a lot of contradictions in that, so there's still some murky areas that we need to delve deeper into. So the things I've been talking about so far have just been the idea of putting a test piece in, putting one microphone up above and recording the noise. We can do more than that. We can also, I guess, record information about the flow itself. We can record information about its velocity and things like that to help us understand the flow processes that are occurring. But something of a real interest to me is how we can better record the sound and from that sound recording determine, pinpoint exactly where the source is coming from and I guess the form of the source. Because again, before we could say, okay, we've put the plate and it makes noise, but where on the plate is that noise being produced? So again, there's a lot of work that's been undertaken in that area, and one of our PhD students, Elias, has been doing some experiments using what's called an aeroacoustic beamformer. That's the guy up there in the top left. The idea is he's just got 63 microphones located on the ceiling of our chamber, and what he's doing is you can think about if you've got a sound source at a certain location, then I guess the distance that sound has to travel from that location to each of those microphones is a tiny bit different. So if you can record sound on all 63 at once and then go away and use your fancy computer to process it, you can actually take that into account and locate the source. And Elias has had a lot of success with that. As an example, on the right-hand side there, we've got flow flowing down past a rectangular plate, and he's been able to localise a source near the trailing edge. But that's still a work in progress, so he should be doing some more exciting things with that soon. Just as a little aside, if we can play the sound for this one. This one's actually producing a tonal noise, so you can actually hear at about 2,000 hertz, if you know your music, you can hear a very sharp peak. And so again, he's trying to really understand exactly where that tonal noise is being produced, because again, there's varying theories. Is it exactly at the trailing edge? Is it a little bit downstream? Is it upstream? And depending on where it is, he can probably couple that to a theory related to how the fluid mechanics creates the noise. And the last thing I want to talk about, I guess, is flipping back to wind turbines. That's one application that probably a lot of people are interested in. There's a lot of, I guess, news stories about wind turbines because we are interested in climate change, we are interested in renewable energy sources, and thus more wind turbines are being developed and wind turbine farms are being put out there in the real world. Now, there are people that have concerns regarding potential health effects of noise created by these. Now, there are, I guess, medical people that can relate, well, if you hear this noise, how does it affect you? That's beyond, I guess, my scope. But my scope is being able to understand, well, what noise is being produced by this wind turbines and get an idea of what we can actually potentially do to reduce this noise. Now, we've got here is a wind turbine measurement, which one of our postdoctoral research fellows, Danielle, and you can see her sitting down there, took a few weeks ago up near Waterloo. So that's at Waterloo, that's up near Clare. So if we can just play that one, thanks. It won't be very loud, but you can hear a swish, maybe. So every second, it swishes past. Now, that's what you actually get with the wind turbine noise. It's a little bit unique, and it's due to the fact that the acoustic sources have a directivity associated with them. So they don't, I guess, propagate sound in all directions equally. So as this blade is moving round and round, there is sort of one location, depending on where you're standing, that you'll hear the noise louder. So every time a blade passes, you'll get a swish. Now, what that means is that if you hear this sound, you're not hearing a constant sound. And there are arguments that say, well, if your sound amplitude is increasing and decreasing constantly, that's going to be far more annoying potentially than if you've got a constant sound. Now, that kind of makes sense because when people have gone out and done studies and said with wind turbines, hey, this is how much noise a wind turbine makes at this distance, how annoyed are you? They get much higher annoyance ratings than if they say to someone, this is an aeroplane going past of the same sound, how annoying is that? So it has been documented that it seems to be a lot more annoying. So we're looking at the characteristics of the sound that are created, which are different to other sound sources. And hopefully from that we can, put more of the jigsaw together. Now, I do admit we're very early in this procedure. It's only these last few months that we've put together our little sound collection device, and we've only taken one set of measurements so far, but over the next couple of years, and with some more students, etc., we hope to be able to take some more measurements and work with other people to put together a bigger picture on this. That pretty much brings me to an end. I think I've had my half an hour, so I'll get off the podium now and Chris and I can have a chat.
Thank you. And please join me in thanking Laura. I'm going to start with the hard question, I guess, which is what sparked your interest in acoustics?
I guess for me it's been a case of like sound to us is something, you know, when we want to talk to someone. Most of us, 99.something% of us, are lucky in that we can. We can hear things, we can talk, we can communicate. If we're out walking around and we hear a sound that we associate with something bad, we know when to run and hide. We know how to react. And it's something that, I guess, we take for granted. But it is so important to us. For me, I wanted to know more about it because as far as, I guess, communication in the ocean, I'm into animals, I love marine mammals. I think it's fascinating that these creatures are able to communicate so efficiently over large distances. And so for me, I'm interested in that. And then for the aeroacoustics, again, I guess I value my hearing. I've had older relatives that have lost their hearing over the years, and I know, you know, how hard that is for them. And so for me to look at ways that we can make sure we're not exposed to too large sounds is very, very important.
No, that's great. And I really appreciated what you said when Laura said sound is a really simple thing, and she showed us that wave right at the start, but then said understanding how it works is so much more complex. And the sound speed profile was something I hadn't really appreciated before. So what's your main research area now, ocean or air acoustics? What are you working on?
I guess at the moment I'm basically all working on air acoustics because we're lucky and we have quite a dynamic group at the university. There's three academics, we've got a postdoc, more than half a dozen postgrad students that we can all work together, and we can get a lot done in that area. We have the facilities. Mm-hmm. So that's what I am working on currently. Okay.
So I'm curious about you've gone through a little bit of postgrad research there. So mm-hmm. So what do you think are the big things that you're hoping to uncover or the future discoveries that might make a difference? What's yet to come in acoustics?
Well, I guess acoustics is a very broad field. I've only talked about a couple of little aspects, the ocean acoustics and aeroacoustics, so I'll focus on that. But if you were to ask someone in psychoacoustics or something like that, that would give you a completely different answer. In underwater acoustics, again, we're very aware that the environment is affecting the noise propagation. And so it really just is a case of developing ever-increasing better models of the environment and being able to relate those more appropriately to the sound. Because there's still a little bit of guesswork in there. Mm-hmm. And the better we can make that model, the better the communication and sonar possibilities will be. So that, I think that's very incremental down in that area. For the aeroacoustics, I think I mentioned during my talk that a lot of the redesign is very ad hoc. There is a lot of excellent theory out there that started back in the 50s and has worked since then, and a lot of experimental results to back up ideas of how the sound is being generated and what we can do to reduce it. But whenever we actually do go and try this, it is always like, well, we think this should work, let's try it and then measure it. And it never does exactly what we think it's going to do. Sometimes it's not so good. Every now and then it's better and we get very excited and go and publish how wonderful our new design is. But it would be much better if we can have a more accurate model such that we can start with our initial design and go, well, this is what it's doing. And then have a better procedure for being able to go, okay, well, this is what we are going to design, and we know before we test it that it is going to be the best solution. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you still have to test it, but won't be as iterative approach, and you will get a better outcome overall.
Yeah, so understanding that allows you to design things in a better way.
Yeah.
What sort of things? So we've talked about wind turbines. And
yeah, I mean, I guess for us in Australia, we're not going to go away and develop a new wind turbine, the whole wind turbine, because, I mean, they're all currently designed overseas, but there are ways that we can look at potentially retrofitting things. And also something that I didn't really touch upon, but something that I guess you can appreciate, is that when we look at a single wind turbine by itself, the noise that you get is going to be very different to when you go and stand outside a wind farm where you've got, you know, 20 wind turbines that you might be able to see. And they can interact in a very interesting way. and I guess understanding how they all interact together more in a bit in an improved way will mean that we can actually, I guess, design the wind farm better and place them in more appropriate locations such that they produce less noise.
Mm-hmm. So that's a bit, I guess, about what your area is doing and what your group's doing. What's actually next for you, though, because it's not the same thing, is it?
Okay, no. I mean, for the next few months I'll be working on that and hope to stay involved in that in the future, but I'll actually be moving on in out to industry, and I'll be working, I guess, in the research and development side down at the Australian Submarine Corporation. So hopefully have the opportunity to go back to some of my underwater acoustics. And one thing I'm looking forward to about that is that I'll have, I guess, the opportunity to, I guess, see my ideas and methods actually implemented directly. Because when you're in academia, a lot of the work that you do is very fundamental, and it's very important, and it is used by others to then apply to particular applications, but you don't have as much chance to do that application yourself. So that'll be something which will be fun to do.
Mm. I mean, I really like that response, because to me that sort of echoes a lot of my initial discussion with Laura when we were planning for this session about that passion in understanding how things work and then being able to apply it to a certain area. I can't help thinking back to your tangent, though, that you where you showed us where they had to go back down and pick up your data off the seafloor. And I imagine you're out on the ship for 2.5 weeks. I mean, that sounds like an amazing adventure, and obviously you've got good results. You've got a PhD out there. What has been your favourite adventure from the work that you've done so far?
I guess my favourite adventure, it's been hard, but travelling overseas, both for the work I've done in the US and the work in New Zealand, has really been, I guess, a defining period for me. I mean, I've had the option to meet some fascinating people. When I first went over to the US and met the other grad students over there, there was a Canadian guy who had sailed from Canada to Australia the year before. There was other people that had done fascinating things, a well-rounded people that had an area of research that they really wanted to do, and thus, like me, they had gone from their overseas country to this research group in the US and they were working on it. So they were really passionate, well-balanced people that I guess I was able to get to know and learn a lot from. And I was able to, I guess, work with people in a different way to what you do here, and the same in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. Get just very, very different environment that you open yourself up to things that you can't, no matter how long you stay in the one place.
Mm-hmm. Is that what you find inspiring? What inspires you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I work with other people that I see have a real passion for what they do, that inspires me. And I guess something that's been really important in my life up to now has been inspiration I've received from mentors along the way. A couple of my school teachers, even when I was back at high school in the science and maths department, they got excited about science. They got passionate about mathematics. There was nothing more exciting than, let's go and look at the Pythagorean theorem today. And not everyone got excited by that, but that really rubbed off on me. And then I guess at universities and undergrad, some of my lecturers, I could tell that they really had an excellent understanding, not just of what they were teaching, but of other things as well. And again, they were so passionate and wanted to share that with us. And some of them have since become, I guess, big mentors throughout my time since then, and as my supervisors throughout my PhD. Again, just the inspiration they gave me, I guess, not just by being passionate, but also by showing the confidence in me and their reaction to when I was bringing new results to them, and they were really supportive of that. That's been really, really important to me.
Is that something you feel compelled to do as well, to share your...
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you're here sharing your passion for acoustics today, but...
I think so. I mean, I think, for me, I mean, I get passionate about a lot of things, but science is one of them, and science is something I do with every day of my life. And I think if you do get passionate about something, regardless of whether it's science or art or sport or whatever it is, it's really important to share that passion with other people. And so I spend... I quite often go out to high schools and talk to students about engineering or my career or things like that, just to, I guess, give them a bit of a taste of, hey, this is what I do, this is a path I've taken, this is why I've loved it. And hopefully some of them have gone, hey, that's of interest to me. And maybe there's one or two that went, oh, I thought that was interesting, but maybe it's not anymore. If that's, you know, the decision that's helped them decide what they're passionate about, that's still, you know, really an excellent thing, I think. So I think it's important that no matter what you're interested in, if you're passionate about it, just share it.
Oh, well, I'm really grateful that you've shared your passion with us today, because I'm very inspired by hearing those particular details about the research that Laura shared, but also getting an insight into some of you know, the places that you've been and the work that you're doing. So I'm sure you have questions for Laura about either her work or her experience as a PhD student and postdoc and where she's going. So if you do, can I just ask you to come up to the microphone because we are being recorded for radio, and ask away.
Thank you, Laura, for that wonderful talk. I notice you refer to wind turbines and the Submarine Corporation and defence technologies, but I just wondered, in terms of a built environment and increasing density and increasing noise pollution, to put it simply, is anything that you've come across or anywhere connected to your researchers dealing with, shall we say, like dealing with a domestic environment to reduce noise that may come from whatever these technologies are?
Well, I myself haven't done a lot of work in that area, but there is a lot of work that is done that, in that area, and there are people at our university and other universities that do that, but there are actually acoustic consulting companies out there that is their job. If there's a new development going up, they go in and they work out, well, how can we design this for the given environment such that people aren't going to have intrusive noise inside? So there's a big industry out for that.
Yeah, so it's just a matter of looking it up, like, on the internet.
Absolutely. I mean, if you Googled, well, I probably shouldn't say Google, I should say, if you web searched acoustic consulting company, that you'd get a huge long list, and that's, they all have expertise in that area.
And it works along the lines of that little shed thing that you showed where you put your...
I guess that's for us, that's just one way in which we can measure noise, but there's a lot of other, I guess, experimental and analytical things that can be done either in a laboratory environment or out in the field. For a lot of consultants, for them, they're not so concerned about the details of the fundamentals. They're more concerned about, well, for this practical application, this scenario, what's best to do. So they'll go out to the field and physically measure, well, what can we hear, what's contributing to that, what can we do to
improve
that.
And how can we reduce
that?
It?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, I had an interesting discussion with a friend of mine who does that sort of who does acoustic consulting, but he does it from the point of view of understanding some of the patterns of how wind moves around buildings and modelling that, which I think goes back to what you're saying. The more you can understand how that sound actually works and what the path looks like, given all of those real world interferences, the better you can then design things, which I think is really interesting. Have we got another question for Laura? Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. Just discussing the air blade trailing edge work you've been doing, given that all of that noise that's being created off the back is a waste of energy, is there some dividend for modifying the design of these things which would be economically viable to get someone to do it and save that energy?
Potentially. I mean, I guess if you're wanting to change the design of the trailing edge to reduce the noise, you are correct that there is an added bonus of having a more efficient mechanism, and thus you use less energy to create something, or you're wasting less energy in a conversion. I haven't done the sums regarding how much it would cost, but if you're looking at two things, hey, increased efficiency and reducing noise, that's the second one of which is very hard to put a dollar value to. I definitely believe that it could be economically viable.
Because you said these are all designed overseas, and
yeah,
maybe different countries have different incentives to do these things.
For wind turbines in particular, I mean, it would probably more of a case that the information would have to propagate back to the designing company, and they would more likely take that into account in future designs. I mean, I guess retrofitting is what you would do when you're trying to proof of concept type of thing. I can't see them going and taking a new design and going and retrofitting all of the wind turbines here. What we can do, however, is give them a good idea of where to place the wind turbines. Well, we can't do that yet, but hopefully that's what people will be able to do once they better understand it.
Because Boeing would get extremely excited about saving 1% on the design of their wings.
Yes, because aviation fuel is very expensive and they travel long distances, yes.
Mm. Okay, thank you.
I had a question about wind turbine syndrome. If we just put aside the idea that it might be psychosomatic, just assume it's actually a medical condition,
mm-hmm.
I wondered, because some people who live underneath wind turbines claim that they're fine, and other people who actually live much further away and almost can't hear them claim that they're affecting them. I wondered if it's possible that what's affecting them is inaudible or subaudible noise. And also, if so, whether there's any work being done on effects on animals?
That has been hypothesised that it is what's called infrasound, which is below 20 hertz, so below what we can hear. That hypothesis has been put forward. It's still, I guess, yet to be validated how, whether that's a valid hypothesis, and if so, what it's actually creating. I don't know of direct experiments they've done with animals, but I do know that there has been, I guess, claims published where people have said in certain countries my cows are getting sick and things like that. So there are people that are concerned that it is affecting animals. But whether or not it is, I don't have the expertise to comment on, I guess, the effect on people or animals.
Because I know military jets that fly through valleys where there are farm animals have been accused of causing high rates of miscarriage in cows and sheep, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
and you know, you were saying that this could almost have more of an effect than something that starts and finishes and then goes away.
I mean, again, though, if you do have something that's always there, it is important to see what are the long-term effects. I was reading recently a wind turbine study where they were recording some wind turbine noise and then playing it back to people, and they were playing back different levels for 30-second periods. And they got some interesting results from that, but you know, you don't know, are they going to get the same, I guess, levels of annoyance as if that person sits by the wind turbine for 2 weeks? And that's something that's still not fully known. And again, I mean, the effects on people and animals, again, we know that if you go to the show, say, and you jump on the roller coaster and you and a friend both get on there and you're both eating the same thing, one of you might get very sick and one of you might be fine and having the time of your life. It could be very similar with effects of noise on people. Some people will be more susceptible to certain effects than others. And there are, I guess, people are more on the medical side that are doing a lot of research into that. You know, we hope to be able to align our research with theirs, but hopefully they'll be able to answer some more of those questions.
Got another question? Not yet. I'm interested about in the data collection side. I still can't get over picking up the box from the bottom of the ocean and how frightening that must have been just to see 3 years of research potentially not being able to be rescued. But obviously, to be able to successfully model such a complex system, you're obviously collecting lots of data. So what sort of tools and what sort of other disciplines do you need to pull on to be able to get the results that you need to be able to produce better design?
Okay, well, I guess you obviously need to have a strong understanding of the mathematics. Then you need to take that mathematics and I guess use computer programming to take your data, take the fundamental physics and maths and the information you know about the environment, and plug that all into a model which hopefully realistically projects what is happening in your situation. And you need a lot of computing power for some of these applications. Mm-hmm. And
Yeah.
And signal processing, so that's, I guess, more electrical engineering, where you take things and you do lots of fancy things in the time domain and also the frequency domain, and you, I guess, pull out the bits you need and discard the bits you don't.
Mm. I just think that's really interesting to think about. You know, when I started the session and we talked about trying to understand the way the world works, we've heard very a lot around your specific area of acoustics, but we've also pulled on, you know, obviously medical studies, electrical engineering. You also mentioned marine animals, and you can imagine marine health, plus the geology of the seabed and all of those sorts of things that might go into really understanding it. So I think that's been a really lovely insight. Any final questions for Laura? I should have just made that my sum up, because I think that was probably what I wanted to say. I think for me, I'll go back to a few things that are going to stick with me from this session. First of all, just as I said, that sound is such a simple thing, but actually modelling it and understanding how it works is so complex, and there's so many different things that Laura's drawing on in her area and will draw on in the next bit that she goes on, which I think is quite fascinating. Thinking about all those various sound speed profiles underwater and how you know which one you need to choose or the pattern of that particular piece of water that you're looking at or studying, I think is really interesting as well. really appreciated getting an insight into the sort of work that Laura's doing, not just the technical work, but, you know, the fact that you're on a ship for 2.5 weeks to do that, or the fact that postdocs are sitting there, you know, next to wind turbines and getting a flavour about what it means to be a scientist and an engineer working in these environments. I think that's been a really lovely insight as well. So if you could please join me in thanking our guest today, Dr. Laura Brooks.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.